Over NBC's coast-to-coast network of independent and affiliated stations, the University of Chicago Roundtable, we present Harold C. Urey of the Department of Chemistry of the University of Chicago. Mr. Urey.
Is there life on other worlds besides our own? Are there other worlds like our own Earth? What are the conditions on other planets? And what are the conditions which are necessary for life? Recent advances in knowledge about the nature of the universe lead us today to review this persistently interesting question of the probability of life on other planets. This is a very complex problem, and several pieces of evidence must be explored before we can come to the main problem. We will be satisfied if we find evidence for any life on the other planets, even of the simplest form. For example, simple green plants, fungi, or yeast, or bacteria, or possibly, and even probably, forms quite different from any that are on the Earth. I wish to introduce our speakers today. They are Professor Gerard P. Kuiper of Yerkes Observatory and McDonnell Observatory in Texas, who has recently been making some very interesting studies on the character of the light that is reflected from the planet Mars. Professor H. Gaffron, biochemist, professor at the University of Chicago, who has been studying the photosynthetic process. That is the process by which light is absorbed by green plants and used as a source of energy for the production of all the compounds that are produced by plants. In this, he is making use of the isotopic tracers. Professor Harrison Brown, of the Institute for Nuclear Studies at the University of Chicago, who during the last few years has been investigating the isotopic composition, the chemical composition of the meteorites, the small bits of matter that come to us from somewhere outside our own Earth. Professor Kuiper, is the system of our sun and planets the only one of its kind in the universe, or are there others?
Well, Urey, we do not know this by direct observation, because if the nearest star had planets like our own sun has, we would not be able to see it. We wouldn't be able to see them. However, we can say this. Only recently, the theory of the origin of the solar system consisted of the assumption that a foreign star came close to the sun, pulled out a certain amount of surface material, and that this surface material condensed into the planets. Such an event would be extremely rare, and if this theory were correct, one might assume that our own planetary system were probably unique in our whole galaxy of stars. However, recently we have become convinced that the planets probably originated by condensation from a cloud of gas surrounding the sun, and the likelihood of the presence of such a cloud of gas of the total mass of the planets may be estimated to be perhaps one part in a thousand for any particular star occurring. Therefore, as we now see it, we would estimate planetary systems to be rather frequent in space.
Well, let's see, how many stars are there? How many stars in our own galaxy?
The total mass of the galaxy is known, and we know about how much each star weighs. Therefore, it is possible to compute the total number of stars in our galaxy, and this turns out to be a 1 with about 11 zeros after it. In other words, 100 billion stars in our own galaxy. But that is not all. Outside our galaxy, we have enormous numbers of outer galaxies, sometimes called extragalactic nebulae, and the surveys which have been made at the Mount Wilson Observatory in California have extended to a distance of about 500 million light years. That means that from the boundaries of the visible space, it takes the light 500 million years to reach us. Within this enormous volume, one has approximately 1 billion galaxies, so that the total number of stars within the visible universe may be estimated to be a 1 with 20 zeros after it.
And of these, 1,000 of them may have planets about them of approximately the kind that we find in our solar system. That is, 1 with 10, with 17 zeros after it, is the number of solar systems to be expected. A very, very large number indeed.
I think Yuri, that is correct. That is certainly the best estimate we can make today.
And of course, we see that this may be the number of such solar systems. How about the chemical composition? Brown, you've been working some on this question of chemical composition of matter outside of the Earth.
One of the more remarkable features of our own solar system, Yuri, is the similarity in composition between our Earth and the other planets and our own sun. Most people believe that the Earth is vastly different in composition from our sun, but that is not true. Actually, with the exception of the very light elements, such as hydrogen and helium and carbon and nitrogen, the relative abundances of the various elements in the Earth appear to be just about the same as the relative abundances of those same elements in the sun. Similarly, it has been found that the composition of meteorites is quite close to the gross composition of our Earth and to some of the other planets, such as Mars and Venus, at least with respect to these heavy elements. By heavy elements, I mean iron and silicon and magnesium and calcium, elements such as that. Now, one can go to the larger planets. There, they are so large that they retain large quantities of hydrogen and helium, these very light substances. But even there, the gross composition, including the light elements this time, appears to be just about the same as the composition of those elements in the sun. I believe, Kuiper, is it not true that the other stars in our own galaxy and in the extra galactic nebulae have compositions which are quite close to our own sun, too?
Yes, Brown, I think that is one of the most interesting results of astronomy, that the composition of one star compared to another star is so remarkably similar. There may be differences, perhaps, of a factor 2 in certain abundance ratios, but by and large, we can say that the stars have practically the same composition as the sun. And if we observe the spectra of the distant galaxies, we get again a spectrum very similar to the spectrum of the galaxy as a whole. In other words, within the whole visible universe, we must assume that the same elements of the periodic table occur and in approximately the same ratios as they do here.
And is it not true that these stars and our own sun are composed largely of these lighter substances like hydrogen and helium and oxygen and so forth?
Yes, they are the most abundant of the elements. That's correct.
Well, now, there may be many places then like the Earth. What are the other factors? What are the factors that are necessary for a planet to be suitable for life? What size? What temperature? What other things? Gaffron, could you, as a biochemist, tell us something about this?
Well, in contrast to the overall similarity of matter in the universe, the conditions under which life appears on Earth seem rather restricted. For instance, the temperature range is rather small. It's between the boiling point of water on the one end and a few degrees below the freezing of water where life really can thrive. Many organisms cannot stand more than about 120 degrees Fahrenheit. Some simpler plants can live in hot springs, have been found living at 160 degrees Fahrenheit or even above. On the other hand, cold does not destroy plants or simple life very easily. And we have, of course, in the form of seeds and spores of bacteria, forms which can last for many, many years, we come to active life again at very cold storage.
Would I understand, Gaffron, from what you say, that on a place like Mars, where the temperature certainly is considerably lower than on the Earth, that as long as the conditions are suitable for life, part of the time that your requirements would be satisfied. In other words, the life in some dormant form might nevertheless exist and wait for a better time to become active again.
Oh, yes, you could have a living season, so to speak, which would be much shorter than on the Earth, but the low temperatures as such would not speak against it. But another restriction is the presence of water. And most living things contain 80 to 90% water, and if desiccated, they die, except again if adapted to survive in the dry state. And such resting organisms can continue to active life again when moistened. Otherwise, they would stay dormant for many years.
Well, would you say, Gaffron, that water may be a characteristic of life on the Earth because it happens to be fairly abundant on the Earth's surface, but that life, certain forms of life, can get by with relatively little water?
It's very hard to imagine, but very little water, of course, if the organism would be so constructed that it would catch all the water available and hold it for a period of time, then it was quite possible to live on very little water.
There's a danger of ultraviolet light, isn't there?
Well, we know ultraviolet light mainly as a factor killing life. We use it in sterilized lamps and so on, but it is, and as I understand, Kuiper, there is plenty of ultraviolet on Mars. We can hardly imagine that this is suitable for the type of life we know it here, but adaptations are possible.
Well, when it comes to Mars, I think we'll all agree that we're not going to assume that living beings of the kind that we find on Earth exist there, such as man or the higher animals. But, of course, the thing we're really interested in exploring is whether any life exists on any other planet besides the Earth. There is a vast difference between the living and the dead. Living organisms have the capacity of accepting materials from their surroundings and converting those materials into living matter, something that dead matter does not have at all. We will be satisfied if we find that even such things as very simple organisms exist on another planet. Now, Kuiper, where are the necessary conditions of temperature and so forth that our Gaffron has outlined for life to exist?
Well, Yuri, I think his temperature zone, which I take it extends from about the boiling point of water to a little below the freezing point, we will find in our own solar system in the zone extending from the planet Venus to the planet Mars inclusive. We must assume, of course, that around other stars we have similar suitable zones of habitation. Restricting the discussion now to our own solar system, this then is the temperature belt which is suitable. Now, of course, there are additional conditions which must be fulfilled. We have the question of composition. If a planet like Jupiter, which is so large that it has retained the lighter elements and has as a result a great amount of methane and ammonia and other poisonous or unsuitable substances in its atmosphere, if such a planet existed at the right temperature, that means at a distance of the Earth, then nevertheless such a planet would in all likelihood be unsuitable to the support of life. And similarly, we may have a very small planet like the Moon. Now, the Moon does exist at the right place. The temperature on the Moon is very similar to that on the Earth. Nevertheless, the Moon is unsuitable. The mass is too small, is about 1% of the Earth, is too small to retain an atmosphere, and therefore the Moon is ruled out.
Well, Kuiper, just what is the extent of the atmosphere on the Moon? Isn't it almost a pure vacuum there, as far as we can tell?
Yes, the Brown, the upper limit of the Moon's atmosphere is certainly terrifically small. We would call it a very good laboratory vacuum.
Well, at the small end, then, of the planets, the main reason they cannot support life is that they cannot hold an atmosphere from which they can gain their food and so forth. At the large end, they are so tremendously large that they retain such poisonous things as methane and ammonia and so forth. Is that your understanding?
Yes, I think that summarizes it.
In other words, in which they hold an atmosphere containing poisonous materials. Or they may be too cold, like the outer planets, or too hot, like Mercury.
And hence, except for Venus, the Earth, and Mars, there seems to be no possibility in our own solar system of life approximating what we know on Earth.
It makes it appear that we on Earth are quite fortunately situated as far as all of these qualifications are concerned.
Well, let's ask about Venus, Kuiper.
Venus may have a suitable temperature, Yuri. The temperature on Venus is, of course, higher than it is on the Earth. Venus is closer to the Sun. The amount of radiation which one receives on Venus is about twice that received on the Earth. So the temperature is correspondingly higher. It's about 50 degrees or so higher than on the Earth. It is estimated that the temperature on the surface of Venus may be close to the boiling point. However, in spite of the...
Boiling point of water, then.
Boiling point of water, that's correct.
Is there water on Venus?
No, Gaffron, we assume that water is really absent, essentially. If Venus were covered with oceans, because of the high temperature, one would expect great quantities of steam or water vapor in the atmosphere. The spectroscope, particularly the very extensive test made at the Mount Wilson Observatory in California, have definitely shown that water vapor can be present only in very minute quantities. That is, the astronomers have found no trace of it. Very, very much less than in the Earth's atmosphere exists on Venus.
What about oxygen, Kuiper?
The same is true for oxygen. Oxygen is also absent, as far as we can tell. The only substance which is found, and is found in very great abundance on Venus, is carbon dioxide. Now, there is one other peculiar thing about Venus. Venus is covered with a cloud layer, which we can never penetrate. We never see the surface of the planet. And we do not know the composition of the cloud layer. It may be dust. It certainly is not water, water droplets, the way the clouds are on the Earth.
Well, Gaffron, doesn't the absence of oxygen in the atmosphere of Venus speak against forms of plant life such as exist on the Earth?
Well, I think the astronomers agree with us that the oxygen in the Earth, the entire oxygen of our atmosphere, was made by the photosynthetic process of plants. So that if oxygen is found somewhere else, it might be one of the evidences for the presence of life.
Of course, in this case, we have neither water nor oxygen. And so it appears that there is no reason to believe that there is life such as we know as Earth, on Earth, on Venus.
Particularly since carbon dioxide is present and could be used by any plants existing there, one would expect a terrifically luxurious growth. And from the fact that no oxygen is found, as you say, one might conclude that plant life is absent on Venus.
Well, we know that there's life on the Earth, which is the next planet out from the Sun. Let's go on to Mars.
Well, the case of Mars is very different and presents an extremely interesting problem. As is true so often in the physical sciences, one can make progress when new equipment is built, when a new recording instrument is developed. I want to call attention now to the advantages which astronomers are deriving from an invention made during the war by Professor Cashman at Northwestern University, who developed an infrared receiving device which was very much more sensitive by a factor of several hundreds than any similar device used before. And this new device has made it possible to examine the infrared radiations of the planets, and of Mars in particular, to an extent which has made possible the solution of certain problems.
Have you ever detected any water vapor in the atmosphere of Mars?
The water vapor spectrum has been studied very carefully at the Mount Wilson Observatory, and the results have been negative. No water vapor was found. The only gas which has been directly identified in the atmosphere of Mars is carbon dioxide, which was found about a year ago at the McDonald Observatory.
So you have not oxygen, which would be vital in some respect?
We have carbon dioxide. We know that the quantity of water vapor in the Mars atmosphere is exceedingly low. And we know also, and that is also a result obtained at the Mount Wilson Observatory, that the quantity of oxygen is exceedingly low, less than one part in a thousand of what we have.
But still, there would be a possibility of a cycle of oxygen, which is formed and immediately taken up by other organisms again, so you would not discover it.
I presume, Gaffron, that you would think that if plant life existed in a primitive form at a rather slow pace that the very small amount of oxygen which could be present still consistent with the spectroscopic tests
that would escape your observation.
Would escape.
How about the ice caps? The ice caps are what?
The ice caps have at times been assumed to be composed of frozen carbon dioxide. We would call this dry ice. And of course, the more common assumption has been that the ice caps are, like our own ice caps, composed of frozen water. The the measurements made with the new Cashman cell have definitely indicated, have definitely proven, that the carbon dioxide picture is out, and we must assume that the polar caps of Mars resemble our own polar caps in that they are made of frozen water. However, they are extremely thin layers, and sometimes we see those polar caps melting at a rate of 50 to 100 miles a day. We must assume that these polar caps are very thin.
Well, Kuiper, one rather interesting thing about the Martian atmosphere is that it probably contains an element that your new cell won't pick up, namely argon. From what we know of radioactivity studies on the Earth, the argon in the Earth's atmosphere was produced by the radioactive decay of potassium. Now, Mars should contain a substantial amount of potassium, therefore it should have in its atmosphere argon to a point where it may well be a major constituent.
Well, now, how about the positive evidence for life on Mars? We turn to you again, Kuiper.
Astronomers have been watching the surface of the planet Mars with extreme interest for, we should say, about 200 years now. If one looks at Mars through a good-sized telescope, the appearance is somewhat similar to the appearance of the Moon to the naked eye. The disk would be somewhat larger, twice or three times perhaps, under good conditions. And like the Moon, the planet shows spots. However, unlike the Moon, the spots on the Moon are rather colorless, they are just dark, while on Mars the spots are distinctly greenish or greenish blue, and some of them are yellowish green.
Oh, and this color of green suggests the possibility of some compound like chlorophyll of plants, which gives the color to the plants on Earth.
That is correct, Graffon. Naturally, if you see green areas there, you think of plants. Now, there is one further bit of evidence which strengthens this hypothesis further, namely that those green areas change with the seasons. In the following way, there is a certain belt around the equator of Mars which stays pretty much the same all through the Martian season, but the green areas in the temperate zones change with the seasons quite similarly to the changes which we observe around us of the meadows and the forests in our latitudes.
Gaffron, what is chlorophyll like?
Well, chlorophyll is the green coloring matter of plants, and we look at it and see it green because it mainly absorbs red light, and this absorption band in the red would be the prime object of study of Dr. Kuiper's to find out about the presence of chlorophyll. On the other hand, life is not bound to the presence of chlorophyll. There are plenty of other coloring matters in plants, and recently it has been found that they too can absorb radiant energy from the sun successfully to produce and synthesize organic matter. So spectral studies on Mars can give several results, and all compatible with the possibility of life on Mars.
Well, as it turns out, the particular absorption which you're describing, which is characteristic of chlorophyll, appears to be absent, or at least present only to a very slight extent, so that it is very difficult for an astronomer to find this dip which you would expect in the reflection of the green areas characteristic of the absorption of chlorophyll in the red region.
But perhaps we can find some analogy here of something which has colors a little bit different from the ordinary green plant.
Yes, and of course the various vegetation types which we observe on the Earth are not all the same. For instance, if we take the reflection spectrum of lichens, for instance, we find that this chlorophyll dip is absent, or at least so weak that it cannot be readily observed.
And those lichens would be an agreeable analogy because it's known that they live on rocks exposed to low temperatures, high temperatures, and can survive very extreme conditions.
That's correct. And then there is additional evidence which is now available as a result of the use of the Cashman cell. If one studies the infrared reflectivity of those green areas, one finds that the characteristic water spectrum, which is so strong, so obvious in all the higher terrestrial plants, is absent on Mars. Therefore, the green areas of Mars must be very different from our forests, from our meadows. However, again, the similarity with lichens is quite remarkable. If we do the same thing for the lichen spectra, we find that this characteristic water spectrum in the infrared is absent, or at least very weak. And so, again, a parallel is suggested between the presence of lichens on the Earth and similar growth on Mars.
Well, I think, Kuiper, that your most interesting observations on Mars would be very difficult to explain on an inorganic basis. I just don't see how one could explain it on the basis of changing rock colors or anything like that.
I'm glad to hear that, Brown. I think that astronomers would also agree with that, that the hypothesis which they have held, namely that those green areas are indeed vegetation, that hypothesis is greatly strengthened by the recent results that carbon dioxide is present, that we have a certain amount of water present, and therefore photosynthesis can take place.
And probably, therefore, that there is considerable probability that there is a low form of plant life on Mars. Would you agree with that, Carter?
I think that is the best explanation we can find for our observations today.
Of course, this tentative conclusion is one of very great interest to us in general. It means that out of three planets in our own solar system, Venus, Earth, and Mars, one is certainly inhabited by living things, and a second one probably is. And this would lead us to expect that out of the very large number of similar solar systems which we now believe exist throughout the stellar universe, that life will also have appeared on these many planets. And it means that at least simple forms of life may exist throughout the universe, and it may be that there are very intelligent forms of life existing. People that are as intelligent as men, and perhaps even more intelligent than men. This subject has such great interest to us because of our interest in what our place is in this universe, ultimately, that it will be well worthwhile to review the subject again in a few years when additional evidence comes to light.
Thank you, gentlemen. You have been listening to the University of Chicago Roundtable discuss Is There Life on Other Planets? With Gerard P. Kuiper, Director of Yerkes and McDonald Observatories, Hans Gaffron of the Department of Biochemistry, Harold C. Urey of the Department of Chemistry, and Harrison Brown of the Department of Chemistry, all of the University of Chicago as participants. This week's roundtable pamphlet includes the full text of today's discussion and two important articles by two leading scientists on, quote, light, waves are particles, unquote, and, quote, science and human understanding, unquote. You will want to receive this pamphlet and to study these significant scientific discussions. Be sure to write for your copy and send 10 cents in coin with your order to the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. For $3, you may subscribe to the pamphlet for a full year and receive 52 weekly issues. I'll repeat the address, the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. Next week, the roundtable will discuss equality of educational opportunity. Today's roundtable originated in the Mitchell Tower studios of the University of Chicago. The National Broadcasting Company and its independent affiliated stations have cooperated in the presentation of this discussion, which brings the American listener various shades of opinion on important public issues. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.